Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, three more states are suing the Trump administration over new rule blocking green cards for many immigrants. New York State, New York City, Connecticut, and Vermont sued the federal government today over new Trump administration rules blocking green cards for many immigrants who use public assistance, including Medicaid, food stamps, and housing vouchers. The states and city join a growing list of entities suing over the change, one of the Republican administration's most aggressive moves to restrict legal immigration. What's the real impact behind this action? For insight, we turn to my first guests. First, he manages a solo practice dedicated exclusively to immigration law, represents clients in complex family petitions. He is attorney Mark Shmueli. Mark, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer.
We're also joined by immigration attorney Carlos Castaneda from the Thomas Esperanza Jr. Law Firm. Carlos, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
So the rules are set to take effect in October. They would broaden a range of programs that can disqualify immigrants, legal immigrants, from legal status if they are deemed to be a burden to the U.S. Mark, how egregious is this?
Well, I mean, we've talked about this with some of the other programs. In a normal, restrictive administration, something like this could pass. But this administration has managed to hit the high bar of violating the Equal Protection Clause in instances, like we've talked about, denial of TPS for certain countries and DACA, because courts throughout the country have found a racial animus. I know that California and other states are looking at the statements surrounding the policy and the statements about immigration that really do come from the top. And this is what's stopped a lot of this so far. So it's really egregious and unprecedented.
Carlos, same question to you. This, to me, I can't stop shaking my head.
Indeed. And let me sum things up. This new regulation is overall bad. It really is. I've been looking through it during this past week, looking through the new 19-page form that is going to be required each time a person files for a green card application, another 19 pages of information about themselves and household members. It's bad. Uh-huh. It's going to mess things up. Now, allow me to add a little silver lining here, because there is some small good news. And part of that is that this rule could have been much worse. And that's what many of us in immigration law were worried about when it was initially proposed last year. Now, one good thing is that supposedly they're no longer going to consider the receipt of public benefits of household members, right? So if your kids are getting food stamps for something, supposedly they're not going to consider that when evaluating your own case. However, they are still asking in this new form information about any income received from public benefits, any income to household members received from public benefits. And so you as an immigration attorney think to yourself, okay, why are they asking for this information if supposedly they're not going to take into account? And this is just one of the many issues with this new regulation, in which it adds a lot of negative factors that can hurt your client, and it makes it very hard to prove up the positive factors.
Well, can I just add to
that? Yeah.
One of the things that we know is that even though it's true if your kids get WIC or something like that and they're U.S. citizens, it's not going to count against you. But we also know that in the community, people are afraid. And we also know that there's going to be a lot of media that is going to misrepresent it, and it's going to scare people, and that people are going to be cautious. And so children will suffer. Children will be, I mean, and this will happen, because whenever there's a chilling effect, and we and Carlos and I both know this practicing, that people are doing things they are restraining from doing things that they're allowed to do right now because they're scared and they're cautious about what's going to come next. So it's really going to chill, even though it's allowed. I don't think Carlos will agree.
Oh, absolutely. I echo exactly it. The chilling effect of everything here is exactly the purpose of these new regulations, and it's also what's going to make it very difficult for individuals to try to seek out legal help in the first place and ultimately get to their end goal of obtaining legal status in the United States as a green card holder.
Now, Carlos, the other thing is that I have usually you're in Texas, you're on the border, you're on the front lines, but I can say that me being in the district area, we're on the front lines because we've dealt with Ken Cuccinelli. And interesting that his successor, Herring, who's led the lawsuit against this, but Ken Cuccinelli was the previous attorney general before the current attorney general who's suing on this and sued on the Muslim ban. So this happened right in Virginia. So it was our clients who were affected by what he was trying to do in Virginia.
Mark, that takes me to my next point. Ken Cuccinelli, acting director of Citizenship and Immigration Services, said earlier this month that the rule change will ensure those who come to the country don't become a burden, though they pay taxes. Quote, we want to see people coming to this country who are self-sufficient. That's a core principle of the American dream. It's deeply embedded in our history, and particularly our history related to legal immigration. Carlos, I looked at the writing on the inscription on the Statue of Liberty, and it doesn't say anything about bring us your poor, your hungry, your masses who are self-sufficient. It, I didn't see that stated. Help me out, Carlos.
Right. I believe the USCIS director a few days ago on Fox News said that, yeah, we should probably amend that to say, bring us your huddled masses who are able to stand on their two feet or something to that effect. And this regulation, and by the way, the federal regulation that came out, the explanation behind it, the notice and comment, that's over 800 pages long. And I've been poring over that during this past weekend. And it's very funny for me that part of the official, shall we say, information given out by USCIS as helpful advice, supposedly, is that immigrants who wonder if they will be affected are encouraged to read through this. I'm an attorney and I have a lot of experience here, but this is opening up a series of unknowns, not to mention a bunch of complicated matters here. So the brave new world that expects us, if this regulation does come into effect, that's going to mess a lot of things up. And it's not just a matter of making people self-sufficient. It is purposefully putting barriers in the way to get status and lengthening the green card process, which has lengthened already by a few months during the Trump administration as it is.
Mark and Carlos, I'll ask this to both of you, starting with Mark. And Carlos, thank you, because that takes me where I was trying to go. How are these determinations going to be made? Are there clear rules and criteria, or are they arbitrary? For example, what's the difference between an immigrant with a law degree versus one who's a fourth-degree stonemason? Is that a valid question for me to ask?
I have not pored over the regulations because I've been out of town. From what I understand, I mean, there's certain categories, certain types of assistance that are black mark added. Then there's this larger criterion over, you know, what feeling do you have that somebody's going to be a public charge, which is almost similar to when people come here and ask for a visitor visa and they want to know whether you have ties to your home country, which is basically denied visitor visas to, you know, almost everybody from lower income countries. And so I think that that's a real concern. So I think that it's very ambiguous. And we know that the intent of the administration is, and we talked about this last week, is to look at people who are of educational status as less able to earn, which doesn't correlate anyway. And we know that there's no documentation to support the idea that immigrants are using public funds. So it's based on no facts. It's based on a prejudice. And the prejudice of the public charge, but then this larger prejudice, which kind of immigrants can earn more money. And as we know, it doesn't correlate necessarily to education, but that's thrown in their education, family money, property, those kinds of things, which is really scary and unprecedented in family immigration.
And Carlos, to that point, it's also based on a stereotype, because we know in this country that it's European Americans that overwhelmingly are on the social dole as opposed to people of color.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot in terms of the social justice aspect that we could get into for a long bit. But let me respond to your initial question as to how it is that people will determine whether someone is a public charge. The regulation does list a series of, quote, heavily weighted positive factors and heavily weighted negative factors, plus a bunch of other factors. But let me get to the meat of it. For USCIS, under this new rule, to say that, hey, you cannot be admitted because you are likely to become a public charge, they have to conclude that there's more than a 50% chance that you're going to use public benefits for a total of 12 months during any three-year period. That's what it comes down to. They think that you're going to use public benefits of some sort for 12 months, not at one time, but throughout a three-year period. Now, think about it for a second. How the heck can you assume that someone is going to depend on this? If someone has used such a benefit before, and by the way, for undocumented persons, most of them are already ineligible for these kinds of programs anyway, so the listing of additional programs that they're disqualified for doesn't directly affect them. But as to all these other criterions, as to, just to name a few, English language ability, education, whether you have health insurance, whether you have a credit score, whether you have tax returns that show your income, or any proof that you are a caregiver, etc.
Okay.
All those things make it such a convoluted mess that I know USCIS officers that are poring over the rule now have no idea how they're going to be administering this, and this is the purpose of this rule, to create confusion and to create fear.
I got to stop you there. Carlos Castaneda from Thomas Esperanza Jr. Law Firm and Mark Schmueli, thank you both very much for your contribution. Look forward to having you guys back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wilmer.
All right. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Planned Parenthood drops out of federal program over fight with Trump administration. Planned Parenthood announced yesterday that it will drop participation in a federal program that supports family planning services because of new restrictions placed upon it by the Trump administration, calling a recent regulation and, quote, assault on access to birth control and reproductive health care, especially for people struggling to make ends meet, end quote. What impact will the administration's actions have on access to women's health care for poor and for women of color? For insight into this, we turn to my next guests. They are both with Maine Family Planning, Jay Thibodeau and Deidre Fulton McDonough. Welcome both to the Critical Hour.
Hi there.
Thank you both for joining us. Maine Family Planning announced July 16th, I believe, that after nearly 15 years as Maine's grantee for the Title X National Family Planning Program, that it would withdraw rather than comply with the Trump-Pence gag rule. Is that correct?
That's right. We announced our intent to withdraw from the program a little over a month ago, and yesterday on August 19th, we sent a letter to the Office of Population Affairs within the Department of Health and Human Services, officially announcing that we are no longer participating in the Title X program after nearly 50 years of serving as a statewide grant.
Now, the new rules prohibit participating clinics from providing abortion referrals and dictates a, quote, clear financial and physical separation, end quote, between family planning services and abortion services. What does this mean? How is it that a licensed medical clinic or facility is limited in terms of discussing abortions that it can have or options that it can have with a patient? I'm a cancer survivor, and I can't imagine my urologist not being able to discuss all of the options that were available to me around dealing with my cancer. To me, These are medical conversations. Help me understand this.
Right. So in this case, we have a lot of the same questions. And when it comes to abortion referrals, not only would a patient and provider not be able to have a clear, straight, unbiased conversation, but if the patient explicitly asks for a referral for abortion care, a provider who the patient trusts for non-judgmental care would not be able to give the patient a straight answer. And to us, that's an attack on access that we really can't abide. The provider would be required to hand the patient a list of medical facilities, some of which did provide abortion care and some of which did not. The provider would be able to give the patient a clear indication of what provider did what. And for many of our patients, this represents just another hoop for them to jump through to access safe and legal care.
This announcement is the latest salvo in a long-running battle between the nationwide organization known for providing inexpensive health care for low-income women, including abortion, and conservatives who say more should be done to prevent taxpayer dollars from going to any groups that provide such services. Jay Thibodeau, it's hypocritical to me how conservatives who are traditionally stuck on less government intervention in our lives, and we've got to get government out of private people's concerns, as well as understanding that the way that the government works is you pay your taxes and the government does what the government does. And if everybody starts to pick and choose where they want their money to go, it becomes increasingly more difficult to get stuff done. This just really seems to be incredibly contradictory and hypocritical.
Sure. So I want to say two things. First, I'm with an organization called Abortion Care Network, and we work nationally to support independent abortion clinics. So we've heard a lot of talk about Planned Parenthood being defunded, and they are the largest single recipient of Title X dollars. However, we'll also see independent community-based abortion clinics defunded. We will see other community health centers lose their funding, school-based health centers, tribal health centers, correctional facilities. Title X dollars go to a huge range of healthcare providers who are working in their communities to make sure that people have the reproductive healthcare they need. There are over 4 million patients a year going to these clinics, and for over half of them, that is the only healthcare they get. So we're certainly talking about Planned Parenthood. We are also talking about a huge number of other healthcare facilities across this country who are providing oftentimes the only source of healthcare that people get at all. And then to your point about hypocrisy and tax dollars and where all of this money is going, the underlying fact here is that the Trump administration is willing to withhold access to healthcare from entire communities, from 4 million people, in order to wage their own personal war against abortion. This is incredibly biased. We should be incredibly concerned about a government that is willing to use their financial and regulatory power to silence healthcare providers and frankly, to interfere in our own most personal decisions about our health and the way that we form our families.
Alexis McGill Johnson, the acting president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, said in a statement that Planned Parenthood clinics will remain open and urged Congress to act. Quote, "We will do everything we can to make sure Planned Parenthood patients don't lose care. While the Trump-Pence administration may have given up on you, we never will," end quote. Deidre, how will now Planned Parenthood make up the funds? What are the options that Planned Parenthood has now?
I don't know how Planned Parenthood will make up the funds specifically, because Main Family Planning is an independent provider. But I know that what we are doing and have just announced our withdrawal is we are currently making up a shortfall in funding. We lost approximately $2 million as a result of our withdrawal from Title X. We are making up that gap right now with private reserves, and we are working very hard to secure alternative sources of public funding, we feel that maintaining and preserving the family planning network in Maine and, of course, nationwide is a public health imperative. We feel that access to birth control and other preventive health services makes communities healthier and gives people greater control over their lives and futures. And we believe that elected officials also see that and want to support that. And it's important to know that Title X enjoyed bipartisan support for decades. And I think that that speaks to the ideological nature of this attack. It seems as though the Trump-Pence administration is trying to undermine a tremendously successful bipartisan program, all in the name of ideology.
Jay, to that point, the Title X, a $286 million program, started in 1970 to support family planning efforts for low-income women. Nearly 4,000 clinics in the U.S. now receive money through the program, providing care to some 4 million people, many of whom are uninsured. So politically, as we're moving towards 2020, as Alexis McGill-Johnson is urging Congress to act, what's the political dynamic in the political landscape here?
Well, I think, number one, people need to get out and vote and be able to vote and not be suppressed from voting and make their voices heard. We actually know the vast majority of people in this country not only support the right to abortion and to access health care, but actually feel fine having that health care paid for with their dollars. We're not a political organization, so what we're urging people right now to do is to find their local clinic, find their local independent clinic, find their local Planned Parenthood, find out who's providing reproductive health care in your community, find out what they need, how you can help them, and where they are. The other thing about this policy that is so scary is that it frees up money to go to fake health centers, which already try to trick people into walking through their doors but don't provide actual medical health care. And so we're really, really urging people, find your polling place and then find your local reproductive health care center, your local abortion clinic. Make sure you know where they are. Make sure you know how to get there. Make sure you know how to drive a friend there if they need you, and reach out to donate volunteer support. They need you. This money isn't necessarily going to flow in from other places on its own. So reach out, find what they need.
You know, Jay, the point that you made about the numbers of people that actually don't support abortion, but they do support a person's right to make a decision in their own lives, that to me right there is the key point. Because it's a matter of these so-called right-to-life folks who are so self-righteous and are so sanctimonious that they believe that somehow in the middle of the night they were anointed by God to go out here and inject themselves into the lives, into the homes, into the personal decisions of other people. And in the number of belief systems that I have studied and the people that I have spoken with, I don't know anywhere in the literature, in the text, that it's stated that it's incumbent upon them to do that, to take it upon themselves to do that to other people.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. We believe, and the clinics that we work with believe that people have the right to make decisions about their own bodies. They have the right to decide when and how and whether they want to create their families. And we believe everyone should be able to do that in safe environments. And so if you want to call yourself a person who believes in the right to life, then you're welcome to join us in fighting for everyone to maintain bodily autonomy for themselves and to be able to have their families and raise their families in safe communities.
The other thing I got to do, and Deidre, I'll let you take us out on this, not necessarily this point, but just to wrap up the conversation, I got to do some studies on those who claim to be right to life and where they stand on the death penalty.
Well, and where they stand on access to birth control. I mean, more than anything else, what the domestic gag rule is going to do is make it harder for people to access birth control, and that includes people in rural communities, that includes young people, that includes people of color, that includes uninsured and underinsured people. And, you know, being family planning provides abortion care, and we're proud to do so, and we will continue to do so, which is one of the reasons why we withdrew from Title X. But if the Trump Pence administration is so concerned about abortion, then you would think that they would not reduce access to birth control. And this program has been incredibly effective at increasing use of effective birth control.
Jay Thibodeau and Deidre Fulton McDonough, thank you so much for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having the both of you back.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, the White House mulls payroll tax cut effort to revive economy. President Donald Trump, he dismissed concerns of recession on Sunday and offered an optimistic look for the economy after last week's steep drop in the financial markets. Quote, "I don't think we're having a recession. We're doing tremendously well. Our consumers are rich. I gave a tremendous tax cut and they're loaded up with money." That's what he said. Oh, really, Donald? So riddle me this. Why are several senior White House officials discussing whether to push for a temporary payroll tax cut as a way to arrest an economic slowdown? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He has a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, Jack, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So, Jack, I got to turn to minds bigger than mine, such as yours. So help me out here. We're doing tremendously well. Our consumers are rich. I gave a tremendous tax cut, and they're loaded up with money. But a strong majority, 74% of U.S. business economists appear sufficiently concerned about the risks of some of Trump's economic policies that they expect a recession that you've been predicting for about the last 8 months in the U.S. by the end of 2021. Is there some inconsistency between what the president said on Sunday and what people in his administration are talking about now, or am I just confused?
No. Very clearly, the preparations here are a reflection of the awareness that the U.S. economy is slowing down. You know, both business investment went negative in the second quarter, manufacturing's in recession. Construction, 7 consecutive quarters, has been declining. Those are the key sectors of the economy. It's about to spill over to services. The growth in consumption is being driven by credit cards, pretty much. And consumer confidence is weakening. So they see the writing on the wall. And what they're doing is preparing to provide a quick boost, really, to offset the increase that's coming and already is half here from Trump tariffs. Estimates are that Trump tariffs are already taking away $600 from consumers on average. And if the new tariffs go through, it'll be $1,000 per household. In other words, that's a tax hike. The tariffs are a tax hike on U.S. consumers. So they're looking to cut taxes here through the payroll tax. Now, you got to look at the bigger picture with this payroll tax cut, because it's really a 7% cut for business, because businesses pay half of the payroll tax. And this is all part of the other thread here of Trump policy, which is to cut taxes for businesses more and more and more. Not just the payroll tax cut here, but we've got indexing of capital gains proposals, which will cut taxes for businesses of and investors for another $100 billion a year. We've got cutting the investment 3.8% investment tax on Obamacare. They're going after that. They're trying to make the 2018 10-year tax cuts of Trump permanent. So there's this whole offensive to keep cutting business taxes left and right. And this payroll tax is really a wolf in sheep's clothing to do that, to cut business taxes even more, to offset the tariffs that are coming on household, which is a tax. And it's an insidious way of putting the Democrats in a corner, because if the Democrats don't cut the payroll tax, and as the recession occurs here, he'll blame them. He'll blame Congress. He'll blame the House of Representatives for not cutting taxes on households to stimulate recovery from the deepening recession that's coming. So he's planning this, as for political ammunition. It's part of offsetting his tariffs, which is a tax hike. It's a way of cutting business taxes even further. You know, it's very clever. But you got to realize that this cutting payroll taxes, the precedent was already set under Obama.
Right.
He cut payroll taxes and he made it legitimate to cut payroll taxes again. Yeah. And of course, we're not in the crisis we were back then in 2010-11 when payroll taxes were cut. But, you know, Trump doesn't care about that. He'll just use the precedent and drive a truck through the opening that Obama already provided. And he probably will try to make it permanent should he do this. He's gathering his ammunition for 2020 election year.
I've talked a lot about, with you, bottom-up, not trickle-down economics. And so if the objective was really to stimulate the economy in a meaningful manner, if the payroll cut had been granted instead of the tax cut to the wealthy, or a more balanced tax cut between the both, would we be finding ourselves in the hole that we're in now? Or would that still have resulted in pretty much the temporary jolt that the economy received from the tax cut for the wealthy that Trump gave? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Look at that tax cut introduced in the first quarter of 2018. It gave a very temporary boost to the U.S. economy, and investment then quickly dissipated once again. You know, investment declined by the fourth quarter of 2018 to only 4.5%. In the first quarter of this year, investment declined to 2.7%. Then it went negative in the second quarter. You know, we gave trillions of dollars to businesses and investors and tax cuts, and we got, you know, a molehill of investment and stimulus out of it. Trillions of dollars and no stimulus, really. And now he's looking to find other ways of trying to boost the economy, because that tax cut did not boost investment and did not boost the economy. What we should do now is to reverse some of those ineffective business investor tax cuts and turn it into household consumer income tax cuts.
Then we're looking at people buying durable goods. We're looking at people buying shoes and clothing and tangible things that they need for their kids to go to school and they need to go to work, instead of taking that money and putting it into the financialized side of the economy. Is that right?
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, those aren't the people who drive policy. Those aren't the people who get Mitch McConnell to make proposals and get Trump to make and the administration to make proposals on tax cuts. You know, those aren't the people who are passing and proposing the legislation. Very, very clearly, we got a big hike from the Trump tariffs coming, you know, $1,000 per household. Trump tariffs being passed into higher prices, which is a tax hike of kind on the American consumer. So how do you even offset that? And if you don't offset that, it's going to slow the economy even more.
But Jack, now see, you keep talking about tariffs being taxes, but Jack, the president told me that tariffs aren't taxes. Peter Navarro told me that China is going to pay for the tariffs. Jack, Larry Kudlow, the brilliant economist with no degree in economics, told me that you're wrong.
Yeah, well, there's there's all kind of economists who say, no, you know, that's a political spin. That's all that is. That's obfuscation. That's trying to distract people. The great distraction is underway, you see, under Trump. He says black is not white and white is not black, and they're both black and they're both white. That's that, you know, kind of logical lying. It's really, you know, politicians, 98% of what they say are lies. They say what they want people to think they're going to do. Then they go and do something different anyway, to satisfy the people who pay for their elections. That's the problem we got. You can't believe this guy.
Do you have any idea, and this is, I think, very, very subjective at this moment, you've been talking about a pending recession for quite a while. Do you have any idea of how deep of a recession are we heading into? Or is this a cyclical bump that after 10 years of growth, we are just destined to have? Or are there some really structural problems because of the way that Trump has handled the trade wars and because of the fact that the Fed has kept interest rates so low that they really have nowhere to go? Do you have any insight into how big of a problem is on the horizon?
Well, the scope and magnitude of a problem in terms of the depth and duration of a recession depends upon whether the recession precipitates a financial crisis as well. That has a lot to do with the level of debt.
Okay.
And of course, the debt level is outrageous in the United States, and the inability to pay the principal and interest on the debt is the key. Households are like almost $15 trillion in debt. The government's over $22 trillion of debt. That's just the national government, another 5-6 on state and local governments. And corporations are up to their eyes in debt.
But Jack, wait a minute. Candidate Trump told me, I love debt. Debt is good. I've built my empire on debt. That's what he told me. I heard him.
Yeah, well, he's a real estate speculator, and that's what real estate speculators do. They borrow money, other people's money, and then they invest it for a capital gains, and then they lose it, and then they go bankrupt. Like
the Taj Mahal and Trump stakes and the Trump shuttle.
And they bilk their lenders. So, you know, that's why American banks would not lend to Trump at all. Well, he's running the economy like he ran his business, you know, and he just may drive us to bankruptcy, too. You know, but, you know, the problem is debt and the debt level and, more important, the ability to pay for that debt when a recession occurs. And if that starts precipitating collapses and defaults, and watch the junk bond market and the triple B investment grade market and the leveraged loan market and the repo markets in the U.S. Those are the areas that you will see a financial crisis emerge once it does. And when that happens, then the recession goes deeper and longer. And there's another problem, too, here that we've never had before. And that is both monetary and fiscal policy that's typically used to re-stimulate the economy in a recession. Both are almost dead in the water.
They've already shot their ammo.
That's right.
The analogy that I would use on that point is, you're a castle and your sentries at the top of the castle see the enemy coming across the horizon and they order the soldiers to fire their arrows, but the enemy hasn't gotten close enough yet. And by the time the enemy gets there, you have no more arrows to shoot.
Well, you know, the Federal Reserve has virtually no arrows to shoot except maybe pumping trillions more in quantitative easing into the economy, which will have no effect, right? And then as far as government spending, you know, we have $1 trillion plus going to 1.3, maybe 1.7 trillion a year deficits. You think they're going to come up with government spending to stimulate the economy with that kind of deficit load and debt load? You know, so both fiscal and monetary policy are going to be far less effective in the next recession, and that could cause it to go deeper as well.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, man, you're good. As always, thank you so much for your time today. Greatly appreciate, as always, your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Glad to be here.
All right. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, Prime Minister Boris Johnson faces fresh calls to ensure no hard border with Ireland in no-deal Brexit. Boris Johnson has faced fresh calls to ensure there is no return to a hard border on the island of Ireland in the event of a no-deal Brexit. The Prime Minister wrote to the EU Council President Donald Tusk yesterday evening, outlining his opposition to what he called the anti-democratic Northern Ireland backstop. In the letter, Johnson said while he wants the UK to leave the EU with a deal, he could not support any withdrawal agreement that, quote, locks the UK potentially indefinitely into an international treaty which will bind us into a customs union and which applies large areas of single market legislation in Northern Ireland, end quote. What does this mean, and why is Prime Minister Johnson taking this position now? For insight, we turn to my next guest. First, a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. As always, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by a political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So, Daniel, we'll start with you. What is Boris Johnson saying in all of that verbiage?
What he's saying is that the British people have a right to determine whatever kind of border they want to have with the Irish Republic. That's basically it. But the problem is that the problem he faces is there are three borders we're talking about. There's a border that cuts between the Irish Republic and Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK. There's the Irish Sea, which divides the island of Ireland from the island of Great Britain. And there's a channel, which separates Great Britain from the continent. Now, essentially, what the EU is saying is they want to put Northern Ireland and Ireland, that whole Irish island, into a common customs union, which will preserve the status quo, which is essentially no border between them. But that will mean a border on the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. Do you follow me so far?
I do.
And that is what Boris Johnson is saying no to. So he's accusing the EU of trying to divide, establish a new border for the UK by trying to prevent it from interfering with the present border arrangement between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. That's basically what she was here.
Jim Kavanaugh, is this an attempt by Boris Johnson to, I guess, ingratiate himself with the Brexit people, but trying to walk a thin line with the folks in the Irish Republic?
No, because this is his position is opposed by the Irish Republic. It's a very tricky situation. Dan explained it very well what the parameters of it are legally. But it's a political question that everybody would like to keep a soft, basically non-border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Okay? And this, if there's a Brexit with no backstop, then you're going to have to reinstitute some kind of... Well, but the thing about it is the British government then could make whatever agreement it would want to make with the Republic of Ireland. And I don't think the British government's going to want to introduce a completely hard border on the Republic of Ireland. Politically, that's a non-starter for everybody, I think. I really, and it's, what's funny about this is the EU is saying, look, if you don't accept this agreement that we negotiated, which has a backstop, then there's no deal. And if there's no deal, there's no backstop. So the backstop is part of a deal that was negotiated that the British Parliament rejected, okay? So the kind of the threat from the EU is not a threat because what they're saying is, well, if you leave, there'll be no, you know, if you leave without a deal, you leave without a deal. If you don't accept this deal we've already agreed upon, we're not going to renegotiate that deal. But if they leave no deal, there's no backstop. So something very funny is going on, and it's my strong contention that the European ruling class, and you know, I think Johnson is playing, and he may be sincerely a hard Brexit guy, wants to leave. And I'm going to tell you, my position is I'm in favor of Brexit from a left point of view, Lexit. But I think the European ruling class doesn't want Britain to leave Northern Ireland. And I think they're creating a whole set of fear-mongering things that are going to – they want that second referendum in Britain. And I bet a dime to a dollar they're going to get that second referendum before the end of October, which is going to try and, you know, what they did previously to get all these countries into the EU. They had to have the referendum twice in Ireland. It was rejected by 53% of the voters. And they fiddled around with it and came back and did it again. It was rejected by the French. It was rejected by the Dutch. But they went and they said, you know, we got to present this in ways so people don't understand what they're voting for. They literally said that. So I think that they're trying to create a situation which has enough fear in it that and that they're going to press for a second referendum in Britain. That's my position.
Daniel, your thoughts. And I go back to my question. Is Boris Johnson playing a political game here?
No, I don't think he is. And okay. Actually, I must disagree with Jim on this. I think the EU's stance is really quite clear. The EU can't afford to cut Johnson any slack, because if they cut Johnson slack, they'll have a cut slack for 26 other members of the EU, and the whole union will fall apart very fast. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I think that explains the EU's apparent intransigence on this question. But what the effect of the EU proposal is that if it locks the Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic into a permanent customs union, so as to prevent the emergence of a hard border between the north and the south, what that amounts to essentially is the first step towards the detachment of Northern Ireland from the UK and union with the Irish Republic, which is the long-standing goal of Irish nationalists. And so therefore, what Johnson is facing, and it's a very real danger, is he's facing the breakup of the United Kingdom, in which Northern Ireland and Scotland, which also heavily opposed Brexit, will wind up siding with the EU and going their separate ways, leaving England, you know, to return to its pre-1706 status as a separate, self-contained country.
Jim Cavanaugh.
I agree with that analysis. And that's why the European ruling class doesn't want Brexit to happen. and because it will be. It's the unionist parties in Northern Ireland are afraid of that precisely. That's why they don't like the backstop, because it would create that border at the Irish Sea that Dan was talking about. And there would be a tremendous amount of momentum then for reunification of Ireland. So as an Irish Republican nationalist, I think that'd be a great thing. But I think that I think the EU does not want to give anything to Great Britain for all the reasons Dan is saying. But I just think that behind the scenes there, what that means is that I think Johnson may be sincere with his position on this, but there's too many forces at work that want to undo Brexit and want to get it back and have another referendum that's going to be pro-Remain, including most of the Labour Party, I think. So I don't know. It's a very tricky situation. I don't know how it's going to work out. But although I agree with Dan's analysis, that is precisely what everybody's afraid of.
Daniel Lazar, how does the global economic slowdown or downturn impact this conversation?
It makes it 1,000 times worse. I mean, essentially, I mean, Johnson is winding up with the worst of all possible worlds. The global economy is shutting down, and England, who's the most important economic sector in England, is the financial sector, and that is directly threatened by Brexit.
How is the financial sector threatened by Brexit?
The financial sector is required to rest on the free flow of money and credit across, from the continent to the UK. And if a hard border is imposed between the UK and the continent, that those financial flows become a lot more problematic. And the city of London, the financial center, will find it
problematic and expensive.
Yes. And so the city of London will find itself at a disadvantage vis-a-vis financial centers on the continent, such as Paris or Bonn.
Jim Cavanaugh, is there a labor issue here as well? There are those who say that one of the major driving forces with Brexit has to do with labor, particularly labor with people of color, as former colonial subjects of darker hues find themselves in Europe.
You know, of course, racism is involved in everything. But in this case, you know, there is a labor issue. And it was the European Union was developed and designed to undercut the power of labor and of the social democratic movements that had power in the various social democratic economies of Europe. That's what it was designed to do. It was designed to make it easier for capital to undercut labor. And it's what it has done. And one of the ways it did that was to create the single market of labor, where there was social democratic countries in Europe had, you couldn't just go there and start and get a work permit. You had to take some time. You had to do this. They were protecting their labor market. That's what European post-war social democracy was based on. And with the EU, what you had wasn't so much African workers as the Polish plumbers were the cliche in England. You had people coming from the Eastern European countries who were willing to work, who had training, and it had an effect on the labor market. And people are kidding themselves if they don't think that's the case. And that's one of the reasons that large sectors of the British working class didn't like it. So, you know, you have to deal with these things. And, you know, the European Union was not, and it's really silly for the left anywhere to think that the EU was some kind of project for diversity where we're going to bring everybody together. It was designed to be a mechanism for capital to undercut and get around the strong European social democratic parties and labor movements in Europe. And that's what it's done. It wraps itself in the flag of diversity and, you know, we have one big brotherhood of man, but that's not what it's about. And we have to realize that the reaction to it is based on the economic consequences it has had for working people in Britain.
Daniel Lazar, we have about a minute and a half.
Well, I mean, I kind of agree with what Jim said and very much disagree. I mean, he's absolutely correct though, that the EU is basically a neoliberal structure which is designed to prevent the emergence of a strong welfare state throughout the continent. That's absolutely correct. On the other hand, I love, you know, free travel of labor. I think it's fantastic that a Polish worker can work in Ireland or England. I think it's amazing that an English kid can go get a job in the south of France or Italy or wherever. And this freedom of travel has been a huge advance. I envy the Europeans for that. I feel like I'm locked in an American prison because I can't take part in that. But clearly the only way out for the left is for labor solidarity, international labor solidarity across the EU, and demands to transform the EU into a basis for a United Socialist States of Europe. But I think that, I mean, saying no to freedom of travel, Jim, do you really want British workers to kick out Polish workers or, you know, kick out French workers?
It's not no to freedom of travel. There's a difference between being able to travel and move around. And, you know, it's the case that the social democratic countries had strong, you couldn't just move to Sweden. You can't today move to Sweden. You have to stay there for a year or so before you get a work permit. You know, yeah. So, and that protects. You're not going to turn the EU into a proto-socialist Europe. It's not going to happen. The EU is designed to prevent that. The only way, what you're going to get, how you're going to get a socialist Europe is to have strong socialist movements in the various countries who are going to unite on that basis. But it's like saying we're going to turn the Republican Party or the United States Senate into a socialist. Not going to happen. It's designed to prevent that. The EU is designed to prevent that. And it's not about travel. It's about who has, you know, you need, I'm in favor of controls on capital. And movements of capital, okay? I'm not afraid to call the movements of people around the world to travel, but the question of, you know, who can come and do you have wage rates? Who can set the wage rates? How is that set? You know, I don't mind anybody can come in as long as the wages are set, as long as they're coming in doesn't undermine the wages, doesn't undermine the minimum wage rates, but that's not what happened. And the structure of the European Union is neoliberal structure is designed to prevent that from happening. So it's really, you've got to look at those issues.
Gentlemen, we got to leave it there. Daniel Lazar and Jim Kavanaugh, we'll pick this up on Friday. Thank you both, as always. All right, folks, You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened, and I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.